Welcome to the MLB.com Executive Access Podcast. I'm Mark Feinstein, executive reporter with MLB.com. We're at Yankee Stadium in the office of Gene Afterman, the Yankees' senior vice president and assistant general manager. Gene, thanks for joining me.
Well, thank you for having me.
I appreciate it. So let's just start at the beginning. You grew up in Northern California, going to Candlestick Park with your dad, who was a big Giants fan. What made you first fall in love with baseball?
You mean just as a fan?
Yeah.
Part of it, I think, is the way everybody falls in love with baseball. When you're a kid, you're doing something with your parents. It's also, you know, it's a great game. It's a great game to watch. And, of course, I'm that old that when, you know, I first started watching baseball, the black and white television was the best. I mean, I'm probably old enough so that if I had been aware of baseball, it would have been radio and no TV, but I'm not sure. But so black and white television, there's nothing like, so, you know, you see it on a little black and white TV and there's nothing like going to a ballpark. You walk in the gate and the whole, the green grass, the blue sky, the players are right in front of you, the color, the action, the sound, the social aspect of it. You can talk, you can laugh, you can, you know, it's just a wonderful, wonderful environment for a kid, I think. I think it still is a wonderful environment for a kid. And that's how I fell in love with it. Although I have to admit that I'm also that old that, going to the ballpark was typically a thing that boys did. You do something for your birthday party. So my brothers went to baseball games and, you know, I went to the ballet or something like that. I even had the San Francisco Giants used to do a little girl's cap. So I had the girl's cap. But, you know, you can't keep a girl out. So,
you grew up in San Francisco, you watched the Giants, they never won a World Series until 2010. You had been working for the Yankees for almost a decade at that point. Were you able to, from a distance, enjoy the Giants finally winning a championship for San Francisco?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I'll tell you what, I don't think you ever forget your hometown team. I mean, sometimes I meet people and they kind of, they humana around, you know, they want to, well, you know, I'm actually a Mets fan or, well, I'm actually a Red Sox fan. But I always ask them, were you born in Boston? Or yes. And I always think you have to support your hometown team, you know, no matter what. So, yes, I enjoyed it. I mean, it was hard not to because my entire family was, you know, jubilant. But I thought it was a great thing.
You went to Berkeley. You were quite a performer there. Won a couple of dramatic arts awards at Berkeley.
Oh, yes, darling.
Tried to make it as an actor in London, San Francisco, and New York before eventually deciding to go to law school. What made you decide to go to law school rather than pursuing an acting career?
Well, I had sort of hung up my cleats on acting some years before I went to law school. I taught English as a second language here and in Europe. I then also worked for Paramount Pictures in the feature film department. And when I was there, somebody that I worked with had said to me and it was a different time in Hollywood. It was a different time, and I wasn't really progressing in my below the line career. And he just said to me, you know, you're just seem too smart for what you're doing, and why don't you think about going to law school, which I had never thought of. So I thought, well, you know, maybe I will think about going to law school. So I studied up for the LSAT, and I applied to about 15 different law schools, and I thought maybe I'd stay at Paramount Pictures and go to school at night. But so that's how I came to law school. I never ever envisioned. I had this whole idea that I would return to Hollywood as an entertainment lawyer, and that didn't happen. I kind of serendipitously found my way into baseball. Because Don Nomura, who was my comrade in arms in my agent career, I was working for a small civil litigation firm in Southern California, and he was a client of the firm. We did a lot of real estate for him, and he had a matter involving infringement of Japanese baseball card licenses. And the opportunity was to go to Japan to interview witnesses and collect evidence. I'd never been to Japan. And the senior partner asked if anybody was willing to do it, as we used to say, on a contingency fee basis. And I thought, absolutely. You know, I'd love to go to Japan. So while I was in Japan, Don took me to a Nippon Professional Baseball game, Yomiuri Giants. I think it was actually Matsui's rookie year, I think. Saw him standing straight up with a stick at the plate. And I'd been completely unaware of Japanese professional baseball. Had no idea that there were even, you know, leagues over there. And considering that the first Japanese player was a member of the San Francisco Giants, I mean, you know, shame on me. But I was just surprised at the high level of baseball over in Japan. And it was incredible to me that I asked him, why weren't there more Japanese players in the major leagues? And Don said to me, well, you know, it's good that you ask. Thank you for asking. That he said there was explained to me there was this 1967 agreement between the United States and Japan, the commissioners, that prohibited Japanese baseball players from coming to the United States. And I had only been a couple of years into my legal career, and like most young lawyers, my first thought was, well, that does not sound legal to me.
Right.
So
just mind always working that way.
Yeah, exactly. That's something's not right there. Don had been looking for some time for a Japanese player to challenge the system, and he found it with Hideo Nomo. So Nomo was our first client to challenge the system, and I was really, really lucky to work with Don throughout the 90s and represent Japanese players. We had cases, it's funny because now I'm an MLB, member of a front office, and where, I spent my agent career basically faxing, federal complaints to Bud Selig and Bob Dupay saying, I'm going to sue you, if I close a business Friday if you don't make my client a free agent. And the times change.
Things have a funny way of coming. Things have a circle, right?
Yeah, I still think I have a lot of fight in me, but I don't have a big fight. I think I have one more big fight in me left, and I got to figure out what that is. But anyway, I digress. We worked together. Nomo was our first client, and then we had other Japanese and Dominican clients. Our motto was no North Americans, because there were agents in the time still working now who we couldn't compete with in North America, and they couldn't compete with us because at the time, Japanese players, we sort of had the market on Japanese players, and there was a Dominican connection through a Japanese team. So there was Hideo, and then Soriano was our next big case, and Irabu, and each one kind of built on the as I call them, the Swiss cheese holes in the various agreements between the two leagues and the Major League rules and the Yakuya Kyoyaku, the baseball rules, and just exploiting those defects in the way those agreements work together. I would constantly tell Don, we have to force Major League Baseball and Nippon Professional Baseball to follow their own rules, because if they follow their own rules, then these things are not permissible. And just there's no substitute for the written word. Just the written word. Get the written word. So we were lucky that we had three great courageous clients, Nomo and Soriano and Irabu, who had to go through a lot to get here. And those were heady times, but it was interesting and exciting to be a part of kind of the change in international baseball and the relationship between the Japan leagues and Major League Baseball, and always a great thing when you're representing somebody to get them their dearest heart's desire. We always used to say that, like a lot of baseball players, you play baseball. That's your background. Particularly, not in this country, they tend to have, some more education and more opportunity than, say, in some other countries. In the Dominican Republic, a lot of times the kids don't have the benefit of education. I know that in Major League Baseball, we're trying to change all that. We do a fantastic job of that at the Yankees, as do a lot of clubs. I mean, it's a mission with clubs. But the alternative was, you could either let him play or he's going to pump gas, and that actually there aren't any, it's all self-service now, so forget that part.
Not New Jersey.
Well, at one time it was a great yes. way to put it.
Yes.
Not anymore. But I think you get my drift. So it was, it was important also to be able to, and I still believe that, working on this side of it, we are an industry that some say is burdened by rules and regulations, but we have, see all these piles of books on my desk. We have rules, we have regulations, we have the basic agreement. And if people follow them, then we have an ordered world. And if people don't follow them, then you kind of have, chaos.
Right. With Nomo, it was, he retired and became a free agent, and then came and signed in the U.S.
So if they kind of built on each other, you know, if I'm going way, I always say like way back, you know, way back before the turn of the
That's
century,
right.
way
Way
back in
back
the
in the
20th
20th century.
century, way back then. There was this agreement, and there were a series of letters that kind of clarified the relationship between the two leagues, between both commissioners. And there was a letter that said, that clarified for the commissioner's office, because good for the commissioner's office, they asked the question. Yes, if a Japanese player voluntarily retires from Nippon Professional Baseball, he's free to sign with any U.S. club. And at the time that Nomo, that we did that, they, I think neither league paid any attention because they thought, he's let him do it. He'll come over here. He won't have any success. He'll go back to
He'll be back.
Japan. We won't even have to worry about it. And then with Hideo's phenomenal success, all of a sudden, and you know, I think actually, I'm sure that Central Baseball may disagree with me, but International, MLB International is the entity that Nomo built. I mean, they didn't have a whole lot to do until Hideo Nomo burst on the scene, and then it changed everything. I also think, and this is, you know, in tribute to Hideo, I think that he actually saved baseball because that was after the strike. Fans were disenchanted, angry. They had a bad taste in their mouth about the whole thing, and here comes this remarkable player and the enthusiasm from Japan. Although initially, when Japanese players in way back in the 20th century, when Japanese players left to come to the United States, they were not treated well. They were considered selfish for wanting to do so. But you know, then the fans in Japan combined with the fans in the United States, it really created quite an exciting environment. So anyway, so that was Nomo, and then
Rambo, you guys basically created the posting system.
Well, we didn't
Well,
create the
you played
posting
a
system
role in the posting
in
system being
response.
created,
Yeah,
correct?
so I mean, Soriano was built on that. Soriano very quickly was the Japanese rules said that you can, if you don't agree with your salary, you can submit it to arbitration, which will be heard by the two league presidents and the commissioner. You can imagine how equitable that is.
Right.
The two league presidents and the commissioner, which I think was the way it probably was way back in the old days here, and they'll render a verdict and render a decision, and if you don't like that, then you can voluntarily retire. And so we're back in with the Nomo thing.
Right.
So we went to arbitration. I think our salary request was remarkably reasonable. I think it was probably the minimum. I think the minimum was the request, or slightly above the minimum.
I mean, he was young. He was
He
20,
was
21 years old, right?
young, and it was like, and it was peanuts compared to what was being paid over here. I think it was probably, you know, I can't remember what the minimum major league salary was at the time in the United States, but it was peanuts. He didn't go in there asking for $2 million.
Right.
Still, because you know that's the way the system at the time worked, because the player asked for it, they said no. So okay, fine. Well, he submitted his voluntarily retired papers, and then he was able to come to the United States, although not without a fight. You know, the clubs in Japan, there was all kinds of threats of suing, and Major League Baseball had to stand by, you know, the rules. You had to tell them, these are the rules. If you deviate from the rules, then you're going to deviate from the rules here. And then with Irabu was slightly different, but the Japanese rules say that if you that you have to sign your contract for the next year in December of the year prior. He, I think this was, you know, a lot of them, when you get to be my age, Mark, it all blends together.
I like this what your acting comes out with your old lady voice. It's very,
Well, you
very
know, darling, it's taped, so you have to
exciting.
portray all the
That's right.
characters. But part of what the case was with him was that obviously there was what we felt was an impermissible transfer of his rights to San Diego. And the Yakkyu Kyoyaku, the Japanese rules at the time, said that if you sat out a year and waited till the following January 9th, then you would, and it was considered a punitive measure, you would be placed on the voluntarily retired list. The rule was intended to prevent people from sitting out because nobody wants to be voluntarily retired and not be able to play. But it was
Right.
like, okay. So that was the tick-tock waiting. You know, we
Right.
constantly reminded everybody that, look, you know what? He's still under reserve to the team in Japan. He can just sit out, and as of January 9th, he's a free man. So there was a lot of other things that went along with that, but you know, it was hard on all three of those players, very hard on all three of those players. Matsui was completely different. He had to wait 10 years for his free agency. Now, I was on the other side of that. but...
We'll get to that.
We'll go, okay, all right, never mind.
actually, before we get to Urabu and him coming to the Yankees, I want to go back to your time as an actor. You did try to act professionally for a short period of time in London, I believe.
Well, London was my dream, of course. Right. London, I wanted to... I auditioned for RADA, and I got a call back. And I don't know, I did like, completely inappropriate monologues. I probably did, Cleopatra or something as a 22-year-old. But I had been fortunate that I was in theater in college and then in the San Francisco Bay Area. So the world premiere of Mary Barnes. And I worked at the Eureka Theater and a little bit at the Magic Theater. And then I really, had a dream of London, living in London. I still do. If anybody's listening out there, I still want to move to London and act on the West End. But when I went to my callback, they very nicely and politely told me at RADA that you have so many excellent schools in the United States. And as a matter of fact, ACT, which was in San Francisco, and perhaps you should consider that. So I came back to the United States and I continued to sort of act in the Bay Area. I did the Berklee Shakespeare Festival, which actually I went and was my first year summer associate job in law school. Was I didn't do any legal work. I did a season at the Berklee Shakespeare Festival, which is summer season at the Berklee Shakespeare Festival.
Great law experience.
It was great law experience. I remember we did a tour in the fall after the summer. So I remember studying for my real property exam, backstage with these massive volumes. You never ever lose the love of the theater, I think. And, that's something I want to do when I retire. But I just want to do a little community theater. It's sort of like the Waiting for Guffman thing.
Right.
The local dentist is Lear. I can play the fool, and the guy, the grocery store guy, will be, whatever. So
when you're young and you want to get into acting, is there a similarity there between young actors and kids breaking into the minor leagues where,
I think
it's a long shot to get there, but you're going to play in every little A-ball town and just give it your best shot until somebody tells you not to.
I never thought of that. That's a really interesting point. There is, because the rate of success is minimal. It takes an enormous amount of luck. You may have the skills, you may have the talent, you may not be able to focus it in the right way, and you may not be seen by the right people. And so there's the pure love and joy of baseball, pure love and joy of theater, and then there's the business side of it that is soul sucking. So the whole point about getting an agent and the rejection side of it is also tremendous. I often feel for ball players also. I don't think anybody, or people do, maybe they do, maybe I'm not giving people enough credit, but, going out in front of 50,000 people and failing, the emotional toll it can take on somebody, and the emotional high of playing, but also going out on a field and having people scream horrible things to you. Horrible things, not even...
And that's sometimes the home fans.
And that's the home fans, exactly. But, the people screaming at you and it's a very stressful game. Luckily in the theater, you do have the fourth wall and you can have, the darkness and you can't see the people out there. But I think they're very similar. It's hard for young people to have the stomach, I think to like really, push yourself, put yourself through that and be able to achieve your dream. You have to go through a lot. And I think that's, and luckily for me, unlike ball players, if somebody in this front office wanted to retire at a certain age and they couldn't go play baseball, but when I go back to the theater, I'm now going to be age appropriate for the roles that I was cast in. So it's a win-win.
What last one on the acting situation, what was your favorite role you ever played?
What was my favorite role I ever played? I liked the Summer Shakespeare Festival. I enjoyed that. That was, I loved that. I loved playing the nurse in Romeo and Juliet. I loved doing Threepenny Opera. That was fantastic. I love Threepenny Opera. And I also enjoyed, I had a chance, I mean, I mentioned Barry Barnes, I had a chance to do a lot of, at least at the time in the 70s, in the late 70s, Richard E.T. White was a prominent director in the area, and he was, he loved English theater and current English theater. So I was able to do some plays that were, I thought very relevant and really hard hitting. Mary Barnes was about mental illness. I was able to do a play called Ashes, which was about a couple going through infertility. I mean, they were, you know, I think there are things that theater teaches all of us. You have to open yourself up to it, and that's what, you know, good theater does, but is also entertaining. So, you know, people don't like to be lectured at the theater. I understand that.
That is true. So Brian Cashman said he first took notice of you during negotiations when you were on the other side of the table. I'm assuming that was the Arabu. Would have been the first time you were across the table from him?
No, we had some other clients. We had Katz Maeda, who was a minor league player who came to sign here. We had, I think, actually, he was may have been very early on. Soriano also was before Irabu.
Oh, was he?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and so Katz Maeda, I remember, I think we got his thing in Japan, which is very unusual, was he colored his hair all different colors, so purple, yellow, green, blue. And I think we dealt with George Steinbrenner on that. I like to think the way I remember it. Of course, memory is a terrible thing. You know, you're always the hero in your memories. I think we sort of had the first and only hair clause where he was allowed to, you know, wear different colored hair if he wanted to, as long as the cap was on.
Breaking new ground. So Brian said he first took notice during those negotiations of you. What were your initial impressions of Brian?
Well, Brian, I first met Brian as the assistant GM. Brian was always so level-headed. I mean, so level-headed, not bombastic, not emotional, always easy to deal with. I mean, really easy to deal with, and a great sense of humor. And responsive. You know, a lot of times you'd call a ball club and they'd bob and weave and dodge and wouldn't call you back, and or if there was a problem. But Brian's always, you know, always accessible, always took calls, always worked through problems. George Steinbrenner was a larger than life, you know, personality.
Also not bombastic and very level-headed, yes, all very the time, level-headed. Right?
So I guess my point is that, and there, you know, there's a, if you want to blast upon the world stage, then you blast upon the world stage. So, Brian was sort of the complete counterbalance to George. I mean, he was the, you know, rational, level-headed, you know, not emotional, easy to deal with. And so that's, you know, he still is rational, level-headed. I mean, you in the media, you know that.
You once called negotiating with George one of the highlights of your theatrical career.
Ah, yes.
What was it like sitting across the table from him, and what was it like working for him?
So it's interesting. When I negotiated across the table from him, I was able to call him George. Of course, coming to the Yankees, then it's Mr. Steinbrenner.
Right.
I always enjoyed jousting with him. I mean, the idea that he wouldn't, tolerate resistance was nonsense. I mean, I think he probably, my experience was that he was just waiting for somebody to talk back.
Right.
My parents raised me with no fear. I mean, and that if you have something to say, you say it. And I'm not a shrinking violet. it seemed to me the easiest thing in the world. You know, sometimes also we have around the dinner table at my family's house, you know, everybody's talking at the same time. And so, talking over George was not difficult because I'd learned that at many Thanksgivings.
Sure.
So I enjoyed that. And then, you know, working for him was the best training in the world because he was so demanding. You had to be on your game all the time. You had to know absolutely everything. He had an uncanny ability to ask you the one thing that you didn't have an answer for. What you just have to say is, you know, look him straight in the eye and say, I don't have an answer to that. I will get that for you as soon as possible. But I always tell people, though, that everything that they've ever heard about George Steinbrenner, good and bad, it's all true. So, I mean, you know, you don't have to make somebody a saint to appreciate what a tremendous, you know, person they were. And the fact that he's, you know, not in the Hall of Fame is staggering to me, just staggering. Because this, you know, George and this family, they are Hall of Fame owners. And I'm not just saying that, you know, because they're my bosses, but because it sounds like that, it sounds self-serving, but, you know, they put the money back in the team. You know, they do everything they possibly can to preserve this national treasure, this legacy that's the Yankees, you know, this vision of good vision of America. And they feel a responsibility to history and the fans. And I think and they're accountable. And that's, you know, another thing. So anyway, it sounds self-serving, but it's all true.
You became only the third woman to hold an assistant general manager job with a big league team. There was Lance Stewart with the Red Sox, Kim Ng, your predecessor here with the Yankees. Currently, you're the only female assistant general manager. Why do you think more women haven't received opportunities for these types of positions?
It's an interesting question. I think that I feel that that I had the benefit of coming from the agent side. So I feel I had the benefit of coming from the agent side. Also, being a lawyer, I think for me at least, gave me the confidence. You know, I think it. Everybody's got to know. You know, Brian Cashman, George Steinbrenner, the only general manager and owner in all of professional sports to hire not one but two female assistant GMs, the only ones. I don't know. Does it? I think that says something tremendous about Brian. Does it say something less tremendous about his colleagues out there? Perhaps. I don't know. You know, I challenge you to prove me wrong. But I think that in this day and age, I think the cultures are changing in baseball front offices. At one time, the general managers were ex-ball players, very close to the field, not a lot of business involved. You know, just, and now a front office has grown exponentially. You know, there are so many elements to a front office that weren't there. So now there was this huge wave of MBAs and Ivy League guys that everybody felt that they were the second coming. And then there's a huge wave of now, you know, owners select data, you know, folks that are heavy into analytics.
Right.
But I think what everybody needs to understand, Brian said to me when I took the job that the job is defined by the person that sits in the chair. And I think that's true. And I think the other thing to recognize is that the job in a front office is not, it's multifaceted. It's not one face. So you can't be, you know, only an ex player. And because you'll fail, you can't be only a Harvard MBA because you'll fail, and you can't be only an analytics, you know, person, or else you'll fail. And I think that you have to find the right candidates who kind of combine a lot of those skills and talents, or somebody who can recognize and put people in those positions. Why aren't there more women? I have no idea, because I guess my sum total of what I'm saying is that you have to be, you have to have a mind and an active mind, and you have to be really smart to be in a front office and to be a general manager or assistant general manager or any of the other people that I work with in my department. And women are just as smart, if not smarter, than men. So I think it's a matter of opportunity. I think it's also because maybe, you know, some young women out there don't know that feel that they wouldn't be considered a candidate. And I just think that, you know, more and more I challenge all the ball clubs out there to show young women out there that they could be a viable candidate, because there's absolutely no reason why. Look, I never played baseball and I'm here, so you don't have to play baseball to
be here for a long time.
And I've been here for a long time.
When you look, while you're the only assistant general manager, only female assistant general manager. There are other women in high-ranking baseball ops jobs. Raquel Ferreira with the VP of Major and Minor League Operations for the Red Sox. Pamela Pitts is the director of baseball administration for the A's.
A long time.
Sarah Gellis is the director of analytics and major league contracts for the Orioles. So there are several women. Do you view that as major progress over the past 15, 20 years?
Progress. I mean, I view it as progress, not major progress. I mean, I think that we all, you know, every woman that is in a front office and is successful in a front office, you know, proves the theory. And women like Pam Pitts, they've been in baseball for years and years. There are a lot of unsung heroes who have been in heroines. I know it's funny because actresses somehow now like to be called everybody
actors. Right.
I know it's a my
SAG mind... Awards is where everybody noticed that yeah. I'm an actor.
That's, I'm an actor. Right. Yeah, exactly. So I don't know. You know, Raquel, when she got the position, I emailed her welcome to the brethren, because that's, you know, what
right.
The one good thing about being the one good thing about being a woman in a front office is that when you attend the GM meetings, there's never any wait for the bathroom.
You, in 2015, you were appointed to serve on the advisory committee that oversees the commissioner's front office and field staff diversity pipeline program. Where do you think baseball needs to improve most in that area?
So I think that baseball, we get knocked in baseball all the time. We get knocked about our drug program, which is the best program in all of sports. We get knocked about diversity. But I think I think the folks at 245 Park Avenue and the commissioner, I probably should have done the opposite, the commissioner and the folks at 245 Park Avenue, Rob Manfred, they have a commitment to creating a more diverse and gender diverse front office and field staff. I mean, it's you know, something that they have committed themselves to, and they're trying to take steps towards that. It's a difficult thing to do because I don't think that the prior commissioner's rule worked, because all it did was send people in for phony baloney interviews, and which they knew they weren't going to get the job, but it was just all window dressing. But I think that's why MLB created the pipeline, which is that you have to create fully qualified people, and the only way people become fully qualified is by experience. So if you create a pipeline of highly qualified candidates, then there really is no reason to say no. So you have to sort of prevent people from saying no. And I think baseball has taken a lot of steps. There are things that we're considering on the committee about, you know, how to create these positions, how to, you know, make it, because I believe that if you are more diverse and more gender diverse in a front office, I think that there is a greater wealth of ideas. I think it only improves a front office. It doesn't detract from a front office. You know, we're not the same. Men and women are not the same. We're different. We bring different perspectives. You know, somebody from a diverse background is different from my background, you know, so those bring experiences that I don't have. So I think that, you know, we're considering the idea of fellowships in baseball. We would, you know, there's a lot of, I'm mumbling because I don't really have an answer actually about how you make it better. I think the way you make it better is just take the first step, you know, take these steps and hire a, you know, follow through on what our history is. You know, I think baseball, you know, Jackie Robinson stands as a titan in the world, not just in baseball. And we have to follow our legacy, and our legacy is inclusion. That's always been our legacy. You know, Billy Beane, who is a tremendous individual and was appointed by Bud Selig to be the ambassador of inclusion. I always joke with him like that's quite a title. But, you know, the idea that we are where I started off in this conversation when I was a child. I mean, baseball is something that kids love, that has everything about that's good about, you know, America. You see all different players on the field from all different countries, not just from the United States. You see black players, white players, Latin players. You see kids, bat boys. Sometimes you see bat girls. You see the people in the stands. You're able to talk. It's not just a, you know, you don't just sit there and stare at a field. You know, you socialize, you talk about it. There's engagement. I mean, that's important, I think, also in the world today. People aren't really talking to each other. You know, so there's, that's the whole part of the game. So I think we have to, in baseball, we have to embrace what makes us great and not try and feel that we have to be more like football or soccer or the NBA. So, you know, sometimes I go off on a tangent and I have no idea where this winding road was going. I don't know if I answered your question or if I just stood on a soapbox and preached. Well, what can we do to be more diverse? Take next steps. This is all great, but take next steps.
You've been a frequent guest speaker on the topics of women in sports and the business of baseball. You've done events sponsored by MLB, Columbia Business School, Beyond Sport, WISE, among many others. Do you feel a responsibility to take part in such events, given your position?
I'm always thrilled and honored to be asked. I mean, I'm just... As you commented early, give me a microphone and you know, the funny voices come out. But I do feel... You know, somebody at the commissioner's office had said to me that, you know, you have to stay in that position. You have to stay there so that little girls can see that there's somebody there. You know, I was talking with Raquel about this. You know, people have to see. Kim Eng is very, she articulates it, I think, better than anybody else and much better than I have. But, you know, young women, girls have to physically see that there are women in baseball. And I think it's important to talk about it. I think it's important to talk about the success of women in baseball. And I'm not, I don't, when I go there, I don't, you know, I hope I'm not complaining. I hope I'm not complaining. And I mean, I'm not, you know, I think that we have made steps in baseball that are, you know, more than any other sport. I'm not sure how many women are in the front office in other sports, but, you know, we are trying to build on the legacy of our past. I know that's in the last 5 minutes, I fell in love with that phrase. So I'm just going to insert it in everything. But,
there you go.
I do feel an obligation. I'm happy to talk about it. I have a lot of thoughts about it. Sometimes I don't articulate them as well, but I think it's important to talk about it. I think it's important to talk about everything, actually. I think that, you know, you can't leave things have to be put out in the open and examined and changed. That's how change happens.
When you talk about having little girls be able to see you in the job, do you consider yourself a role model with that in mind?
I guess by virtue of the fact that I am the assistant general manager at the New York Yankees, yes. I mean, I could, you know, probably wear a clown suit and floppy shoes, but by virtue of the fact that I'm the general manager, yes. I'd like to
be. You'd be in the New York papers a lot more.
I would.
Floppy shoes.
I know. I'd be on the back page
rather than.
But I do feel a responsibility, and I'd like to be a role model just by virtue of the fact that I'm here. I've been here 16 years, and you know, I've been treated well, and we've done a lot of things that I'm proud of. So.
In doing some research for this, I saw that the Sporting News once tabbed you as one of its Power 100. And the New York Post has twice named you one of the 50 most powerful women in New York. What does power mean to you?
You know, I always think power, you know.
Stand at the top of the mountain,
I mean,
right?
With the, you know, thunderbolts.
Right.
So I think power is probably means that you have the ability to change things. That's probably what power means. I mean, there are different... You know, there's political power, there's physical power, there's emotional power, there's all that sort of stuff. But I think power should be the ability to change things. I'm not sure that I've used all of my power. and I probably have, you know, greater superpowers than I've been using. And it's kind of a wake-up call to try and use those superpowers a little bit more. But I think that's probably what power means.
And follow on that, Brian once called you, quote, a very powerful woman in a baseball world of men. Does gender ever come into play when it comes to doing your job?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, I did mention, you know, the flippancy about the male and female bathrooms at the general manager's office. But
that's a plus.
Yeah. yes, I mean, initially when I've you know, initially, I've told this story before. When I first became the assistant GM here, all assistant GMs, well, Kim was at the Dodgers, but primarily people think of assistant GMs as being men. So when Brian would introduce me, he would introduce, "This is my assistant." Now, if you point to a man and say, "This is my assistant," they assume it's the assistant GM.
Right.
And when he pointed to me, it was basically, "Get the coffee and you know, excuse me, where may I hang up my coat?" You know,
right.
That sort of stuff. So I got this, I trained Brian. I told him, "You can't, you know, I'm sorry, but you're going to have to, you got to validate me." So he had this whole little speech that he would have to run through, which is, "This is Jean Afterman. She's my assistant general manager. I took her from the dark side. She used to be, you know, an agent. She's a lawyer." So that people, and I could see, physically see the synapses trying to connect, like, "Wow, what's a lawyer doing getting coffee?" You know, I mean, that would be the first thing. Like, what's a lawyer doing taking notes? You know, I mean, that. So, I think if you ask women in baseball front offices, they probably tell you the same thing, which is that it does get tiring to have to prove why you're sitting there, and to have to. It may not be an overt question, but it could be, you know, an unconscious question. Like, and I know that you know, people when your skin isn't white and you're the only person that walks into a room, you get the same thing, probably to a greater extent, or maybe not. But you know, when you're the only woman and you walk into a meeting, you are the only person there. So gender does play a factor. I do have to say that I've never, from ball players, from the time I represented them clear on through now, I've never ever had any discrimination from ball players. I mean, I think maybe it's because I was a lawyer and they're like the last group that that respects lawyers. Never heard a ball player tell a lawyer joke. Because, but you know, I felt more gender discrimination litigating in California Superior Court than I ever felt, you know, working with baseball players.
16 years into this, do you still feel the need to prove yourself?
You know, I guess difference is I'm not using the right word or explain why I'm there.
I mean, at this point, everybody in baseball knows who you are. There's no, people don't still look at you as, you know, "Oh, she must be Brian's assistant."
Well, I'll tell you what, I get, and I'm sorry to say, and it's not just because I'm a Cal graduate, I'm sorry to say, it's from a lot of those prestigious Ivy League schools. I get
the
emails.
I didn't go to one, it's okay.
Good. Good, atta baby. I do get an email, "Dear Mr. Afterman, I have followed your career with interest." You know, this is what they're teaching them in MBA programs. But I'll tell you what I do. I'm not proud of it, but whenever I respond to an email in somebody in a front office or somewhere, I make sure that it has my signature on it. You know, it says, "Jean Afterman, you know, ESQ, you know, Senior Vice President and Assistant General Manager," because there, I think the general assumption still amongst front offices. Listen, I know the GMs, I know the assistant GMs, but there are a lot of people that are directors of baseball operations or just getting into baseball, and you know, they generally will think that a woman is the you know, is the secretary. And I'm kind of, you know, I'm not proud of it, but I'll just slap that email signature on there and like a big banner.
Right.
But that probably says more about me than about the world. I think that I don't see any man having the need to do that. But I think for a lot of women, they do, you know, you still have to, I'm at this table, you know, because I have the talent to be at this table, because I have the smarts to be at this table, because, you know, I've been at this table for 16 freaking years. But, you know, times are changing.
I know you've been asked this question 100 times, but I'm going to make it 101. Do you want to be the first female general manager in Major League Baseball history?
No. No, I mean, well, when you put it that way, it's that. So do I want to be a general manager? No, I don't want to be a general manager. I don't. Team president, possibly, but not.
I've read that. You've said team president would be the more likely step for you.
Well, likely.
If you had your choice.
If I had my choice.
Right.
No, I, I, um, No, for some reason it just it's not appealing to me. I mean, I've had a really it's incredible, you know, being an assistant GM to Brian Cashman. I can't think of, you know, I don't think there's any better job in baseball. And so I don't think I'd want to I don't even think I'd give this up to be a team president. You know, I got a great gig here.
What's for those who don't know, what does your typical workday consist of during the season?
So
We don't need the
let's
whole TikTok,
no
but
no no
just
I know I
generally
know I
speaking.
know so usually what I do is so I'm like at a movie studio. I'm probably business and legal affairs with a team. We have a separate, you know, general counsel and legal department, and they handle, you know, the stadium and the tickets and all sorts of stuff like that. But I do the all the legal matters and the business matters for the for baseball operations. So that's the major league team, that's our minor league affiliates, Dominican Republic, anything having to do with baseball. So a lot of it, in a way, is almost being, you know, like on-call counsel. And we have issues that come up with player licensing. In any given day during the season, you know, I am also involved in conversations when we all meet about acquiring somebody. So and the work goes on even during a season. Every club is always trying to make themselves better day in and day out. So generally there's a sort of a purely baseball operations meeting going over strengths and weaknesses of the club, you know, who's available, who might be available, who's not available. Sometimes you have to get on the phone with the team trainer or the doctor and find out if there's something, you know, going on with a player, or when do you anticipate that this guy's going to be able to come off the DL. I get calls from our affiliates about if they can use a particular player image likeness. I work closely with the corporate sponsorship department, because there are restrictions on who we can take on as sponsors, and those are guided by the you know the rules and the regulations. And sometimes there's, you know, there are a lot of labor matters in the Dominican Republic that you know I work with local counsel on. So it's generally sort of a hodgepodge. And then
So when
at
Brian calls you his compliance officer,
That's what I, yeah.
that's a pretty good title.
Yes, that's a pretty good title. I usually also on a game day, I'll head down there between 4 or 4:30 to the clubhouse. I'll take a turn around the clubhouse and step outside so that the coach, Joe, the coaches, the players, and the clubhouse staff see me. It's kind of because if they have a question or a concern, it's much better to be there so they can talk to me. It's kind of daunting to come up to 4 floors or to call, but sometimes if I'm walking around, somebody will say, "Gene, Gene, Gene, you know, I got a question, I got a question." So I do my spin around there, and if there's something that has to be dealt with upstairs, you know, then hustle up. But and then, you know, like I hope millions of Americans out there, then I just sit in my chair, turn on the television, watch a Yankee game.
I think most people's perception is that the off season is when a front office is busier than in season, but it sounds like for you that might not be the case.
Well, I think we have a set baseball calendar. That's where it's so much like the theater. You know, you have your rehearsals, your tech rehearsals, you go into production, then you go into your next, you know, series. So, the off season has a very set, you know, you have free agents, then you prepare for salary, you have the free agents, Rule 5, salary arbitration, then, you know, the everything preparing for the for that roster. But once opening day hits, there are always going to be things. And then during the season, you lead up to the amateur draft. Then you lead up to, you know, the non-waiver trade deadline, and then you lead up to the postseason. And every single day, there is so much that goes on before a team takes the field, just to get them on the field.
Right.
And even little things like, is somebody wearing, you know, shoes that are the wrong color? Or, you know, I mean, even everything, every little detail. Baseball is a very detail-oriented game. I always refer to it as the mundane business of baseball.
In 2007, you, Brian, and Randy Levine went to Asia, formed a working agreement with the Chinese Baseball Association. Do you think there's untapped baseball talent in China that could eventually impact the big leagues? And not only China, but other parts of the world for that matter, where it seems like you look at the majors and it's, you know, North America, Latin America, Asia, or, you know, Japan really, not even Asia, a little bit of Korea maybe, or Taiwan, you've had some
Right,
players.
yeah.
But it seems like there's an awful lot of the world where we haven't found baseball players, and yet maybe they're out there?
I think they are. Don Nemora and I always had a dream that there was some, you know, like 6'5" young athlete in northern China that could throw like 110 miles an hour, and we were going to find him and, you know, bring him here. And I think, you know, there are other clubs that have done some very interesting things with signing players from India or Africa successfully.
Sure.
I do believe that there are, I think there's untapped raw talent out there. The funny thing is when we were doing work with China, and once again, when you're dealing with China, everything has to go through the commissioner's office. So I went with some of our scouts to a youth tournament in Chengdu in the interior of China. And there was a youth tournament, and they'd all had the benefit of Japanese coaching and Japanese. It's a lot about small ball, doing all the fundamentals in small ball. And there were like these 6'2" kids playing baseball. And I remember it was like the eighth or ninth inning, and these big, broad players, and you just wanted them to swing for the fences. And I think we saw 7 successive bunts. You know, bunting the guy over, bunting the guy over, bunting the guy over. And, you know, one of our scouts was like, "Hit the ball!" So, and they were capable. I think the problem is for baseball is not something that you can just pick up and do. It's not like picking up a ball and throwing it into a basket, which takes an enormous amount of skill. But baseball has to kind of also be in the same way that we're a part of culture. You know, there's a huge culture of baseball in Japan and a huge culture here and in Latin America and Korea and Taiwan. So it's a cultural entity. And if you don't start off playing baseball, we just have to get you at least in your junior high to high school years, you know, and that's where you have to give opportunities to athletes in other countries to be able to play baseball. So do I believe? Yeah, I do. I absolutely do. It's a game that requires smarts and skill. I've never met a dumb ball player. You know, you have to have smarts. And I think that there's some raw untapped talent out there, that just hasn't found a home in other sports, you know, and there's something that would be very appealing about the, you know, it's a team game where you can be entirely lonely. I mean, you can be, you know, it's a team sport, but it's not a team in the same way that, say, football or the NBA.
Right.
But I think it can be very appealing for children and you know, teenagers. It's a very appealing game to play. Not that I ever played it, but it's a very appealing. I've heard it's a very appealing game to play.
You mentioned before that, you know, back in the old days, GMs were all former players.
Yeah.
And that's not the case anymore. Whether
right.
it's the NBAs or the analytic guys, or, I think Jerry DePoto right now is the only GM that actually played in the major leagues. You guys have several former players in your baseball operations department: Tim Nehring, Kevin Reese, Dan Geis, among them. What do those guys bring to the table that somebody who never played the game couldn't possibly bring?
Oh, I think a tremendous amount. I mean, sometimes I feel hamstrung by not having played the game. I mean, I still, as you probably know, in the theater. The stage right and stage left are the opposite, so it's from the actor's point of view rather than the audience. So I still sometimes have to remind myself it's not the same. You know, that is definitely right field, and that is definitely left field. But I think I think it's the same way in the, you know, for anything, like in the theater. I think I probably have a greater understanding of what's going on stage, having actually done it. And I think that what former players bring is, number one, the ability to the understanding of the emotional impact of what you're doing, recognition of talent, recognition of where there's an injury. You know, if you've physically done something, you're better able to recognize it in others. You probably know everything there possibly is to know if you just picked up some writer just came on the scene. You would know immediately what they're doing, what angle they're doing, what they seem to be trying to do. You know, if you're if you're if you're that person, then you're probably going to be a fantastic editor at a major newspaper. I hope there are major newspapers.
Are there still major newspapers?
But I mean,
I used to work for one of those.
Yeah, well, I hope they. I still have my New York Times subscription.
There you go.
So I think that they are able to. Their evaluation skills are clearly, superior to mine. But that's not my job. And I think that having played the game, they probably have a greater understanding of, well, not probably, they definitely have a greater understanding of the game than somebody who hasn't played the game. But that's only one side of it. So, you know, just because you're an ex-player doesn't mean that you're going to be a great scout, doesn't mean you're going to be a great pro scouting director. You just have to have more than that, which these guys do.
Much was made of your role in helping recruit Hideki Matsui to the Yankees. Given your history with Japanese players, was there pressure on you to help deliver him here at the time?
Well, actually, I remember when I went over, so I flew over to Japan and I waited I think it was 22 days. I was there until the date in November when he was able to, when NPB would declare him a free agent. I remember George told me, head west, you go to Japan, but if you don't bring him back, just keep heading west. Don't ever come back. I
got a little George voice in there too.
I'm not good on George, but difficult to imitate. I knew that he had said that his favorite player was Babe Ruth, and so when you are recruiting for the Yankees, I think it's not to be Yankee centric, but there is part of your work is already done for you because you do have the history and the tradition and it's the New York Yankees, and all of the great ball players that have gone before and there was a connection, of course, obviously between Babe Ruth and Lou Gehrig, who went over to Japan, so I think it, for me, it was, I sort of knew that he wanted to be a Yankee, but a smart player, smart agent, they played their cards close to the vest and, didn't declare themselves. But you also have to, I think when you're, that's the other thing about baseball, when you're working with international players, players from different countries, in the same way that women are different from men, we're not all the same the world over. And there are things that culturally that are important in Japan, culturally in the Dominican Republic, culturally in Mexico. I mean, there are different ways to approach a player, and you have to have, for crying out loud, you have to approach a player in North Dakota differently than you approach a player in Southern California. So there are different things that appeal to them, different things that make them tick, and where they, there's an approach. So my experience with Don and with our Japanese players held me in good stead with that.
Matsui obviously won the World Series MVP in 2009, the one World Series that the Yankees have won since you've been here. You guys went to Washington the following season, brought the World Series trophy. President Obama welcomed you in. And when he was about to pick up the World Series trophy, you said, quote, "Let him hold it. He may not get a chance again." Of course, he's a White Sox fan. And
that was my point. My point was not that he would never, the Secret Service almost tackled me to the ground because there was an implied threat.
You later said you immediately regretted saying the comment as everybody sort of oohed at the time. And I believe your exact quote was, "Man, that sounded Republican."
Yeah.
What was that entire experience like for you of going to the White House and having that happen and just sort of that whole day?
Well, going to the White House was remarkable. I mean, I have always been an Obama supporter. I campaigned for him. I voted for him twice. And I respect, everything he has done in office. What I wanted to say was, he's a huge White Sox fan. So we had almost talked about it, kind of a couple of the players and I had joked about it, beforehand, which is like, okay, there are going to be one or two references to the White Sox, but, this is our day. So, and so that's, the way it came out wrong. It came out wrong because I remember the minute I heard this. Who said that? Who said that? That sounded like a woman's voice.
I was in the East Room behind the other ropes that day, and I remember just hearing everybody go, "Ooh," like what did she just say? And we couldn't really hear you clearly from where we were standing. But
I think, and he responded as in the only way he could, which is like, and you wonder why people hate you.
That's right.
I think that's what he said. But you know, that was sort of my, you know, and one of the great things I think about President Obama was that, you know, he has a very, he has a really nice manner about him, and why I felt comfortable doing that. Kenny Williams, who is a friend of President Obama's and plays basketball with him, and was the general manager of the White Sox, and he texted me like, "Look at you talking smack with the president," and you know, there goes there went my idea of like, you know, having a position in the administration.
At the time, I think you noted in sort of defense of what happened and your apology afterwards, that you were one of the few Democrats in the Yankees front office, and you've described yourself as a red-hot liberal. Do you consider yourself to be a very political person?
I do. I do. I consider myself to be a red-hot liberal still. I also, you know, for there's the line, which is absolutely true, you know, for women, the personal is political. And yes, I consider myself to be a political person. I care very deeply about what happens in this country and in the world. And I think you can't, I think sometimes we, you know, we live in the bubble of baseball. We're all concerned about wins and losses and, you know, war and ERA and all that sort of stuff. But there's a larger world out there in which things are happening, and I think you have to participate in that.
We hear all the time about players going to hospitals and different charity organizations. We don't hear about a lot of the stuff that other people do. You've been very active within the Bronx community, working with PS35, which is just a few blocks from here at elementary school.
In the shadow of Yankee Stadium.
You've organized Yankee-sponsored readathons, directed a mentoring program where team employees are matched up with fourth and fifth graders. Not everybody takes the time to do these kinds of things. Why is this work so important to you?
Well, I have co-number ones.
One and one A.
You know, my family has always been about volunteering and giving back, and that's something that my parents raised me with. My mother volunteered in the public schools. My father gave his time. The Yankees are very much, we don't publicize it. Nobody knows about the work of the Yankee Foundation. Mr. Steinbrenner had the idea that if you tell people the good that you're doing, then it's not good. You're doing it because you want to say, look at me, look at me. So part of this organization is giving back. That's always the culture here. The culture is doing things for the community, and there's no pressure to do so, but you know, the Steinbrenner family and the Yankee organization, they support it and encourage it. And I'm grateful for that. I think a lot of employees here are grateful for that. It's they allow you the time to do things in the community. They support that, doing things in the community. So not every company that one works for would do that, but that's very much a part of the fabric here.
Last question for you. We're sitting here just a couple of days after number two was hung up in Monument Park. We've heard a lot of Derek Jeter stories this week. You were around him for a very long time. What's your favorite Derek Jeter memory? Either personal or on the field.
Oh, well, you know what? Number one, he had a great sense of humor. Very funny guy. I think when you think of memories, you think of like something that where your paths crossed. I think it was in 2009, one of the champagne celebrations, he poured a bottle, you know, over my head or something like that, which, you know, when you're in the schoolyard, it's like, oh my God, like, a bottle of champagne poured over my head by the team captain. So I think he was doing an interview. Doing an interview. It's almost reminded me of like, you know, maybe timing is not so good, like the whole Obama thing, but he was doing an interview with one of the networks, and I came over with a bottle of champagne, and I, you know, pulled the top of his jersey and I poured it down, you know, his back, and I just heard the woman who was interviewing go, "Gene Afterman," you know, and I thought, oh, timing, not so. But, you know, it was great. It was great to, you know, to celebrate. Everybody else knows all the great things about Derek Jeter and, you know, knows the, I mean, he's the, you know, the giving back to the community, the participating in the community, the what it meant to be a Yankee, the tradition, the history, that was, you know, that was everything about Derek Jeter. But I think the one thing that I hope people are catching up on is when he has said since then that, you know, there are new memories and there are new things that are happening. And I really feel that that he feels that he's a part of that river. The river keeps going. You know, he may have stepped away from the field, but he's, you know, forever a Yankee, forever part of the Yankee family. But also that, you know, when he arrived, there were many players before him. And when he leaves, there are many players after him, that you take those memories and you build on them. And I think that's, you know, that's something that everybody has to remember. Baseball is like from when I was a kid, you know, the river keeps going and it, you know, there'll be baseball 100 years from now. So I think just being a part of that river, I've been a part of the Yankees for 16 years. I've known, you know, fantastic individuals in on the field, the players, the coaches. It's been, you know, just an honor and a privilege to know all of them, and to work with them. And you know, I hope I know when to hang up my cleats. That's my deal.
Gene Afterman, Senior Vice President and Assistant General Manager of the New York Yankees. Thank you very much for your time. It's been a lot of fun.
Oh, it has. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Gene.